All right, well, we're going to continue in our series on discipleship, following Jesus in the way, and we're in Mark chapter number 10. We started this a few weeks back, and we have just a few. We're almost at the end of this particular study, but hopefully it's one that's been a blessing. It's been certainly been a blessing to me and helpful to me. But we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 34. And the title of the message this morning is Amazed and Afraid. So we're in Mark chapter 10, beginning with verse number 32. And they were in the way going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus went before them, and they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid. And he took again the 12 and began to tell them what things should happen unto him, saying, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles. And they shall mock him, and shall scourge him, and shall spit upon him, and shall kill him. And the third day he shall rise again. Well, the encounter with the rich young man coming a little earlier here in chapter 10 was an encounter with one who could not part with his many possessions in order to gain eternal life and follow Jesus. And that led to two particular exchanges between Jesus and the 12. So the first exchange was in verses 23 to 27. And that exchange left the disciples in what Mark describes really as just a sort of a dumbfounded amazement. Jesus had commented on this rich young man by noting how hard it is for rich people to enter into the kingdom, meaning to be saved, to have eternal life, and so on. Well, the disciples just could not reconcile Jesus' statement in their minds, and they concluded that none could be saved. They essentially asked Jesus, well, who then can be saved if this is the case? And Jesus, he did not really resolve their tension. He simply stated that it was only possible with God. God, the one with whom all things are possible. And in the second exchange is in verses 28 to 31. And this exchange showed the disciples' focus on rewards, what they would receive, because they, unlike the rich young man who went away grieved, they had left all to follow Jesus. Well, Jesus assured them that there will be reward. There'll be reward for all those who leave all and who follow after him. He mentioned houses and lands and brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and so on, which at first glance seems grand and romantic, doesn't it? Well, I've left all. I've left houses and lands and brothers and sisters behind. But when we begin to think about it, it's also rather commonplace. You know, you've left a brother to follow Jesus, so you will have 100 brothers. That's probably not what they were expecting in terms of rewards coming to them. You know, we've left all this. We've given up these things in order to follow you, and what we're getting back is sort of just more of the same. Probably unexpected. Now, Mark doesn't give us any reaction on the part of the disciples, but he does give Jesus words that confirm that there is an upset of expectations, and that's verse 31, but many that are first shall be last, and the last first. So great rewards now, or apparent rewards now, does not equal great rewards in Christ's kingdom to come. Another way of putting it might be that we shouldn't be quick to judge by the appearances of what appears to be blessed and prosperous and successful. Well, Jesus also included, though, in that list of these rewards, a very unusual item. And that item was persecutions. He said in verse 30 that you'll receive 100-fold now in this time, houses and brethren and sisters and mothers and children and lands, with persecutions. Leaving all to follow Jesus in this life, he says, comes with persecutions. And actually, when you look into that word, it doesn't refer to a run of bad luck. It doesn't refer to the general trials and difficulties of life that we all face and have to overcome. And some seem to face more than others, and some seem to do better at overcoming than others. But that's not what he's talking about when he mentions these persecutions. In fact, the word refers more to design, to intent, even to organization, that there could be a systematic component to these persecutions. In other words, it's more of a program of persecution, which more likely reflects on persecutions coming down from authorities, from people in positions of power and influence, and who are able to persecute and oppress in such a systematic way. In other words, Jesus says, you will be targeted for harassment. You will be targeted for oppressions for Jesus' sake. That hardly seems like a reward, but it certainly does set up what follows in the passage we're looking at this morning. So in verses 32 to 34, Jesus gives actually his third prediction of his crucifixion and resurrection. So we are in this series on discipleship, and we are covering a section. This is just a part of Mark's gospel that begins there in chapter 8, I think in verse 22 or so, and runs through the end of chapter 10. And in that section of Mark's gospel, Jesus has ended his public ministry in Galilee, and he's on the way to Jerusalem. So after chapter 10, he actually arrives at Jerusalem, and then we have what unfolds as the last week of Jesus' life. So this section of Mark's gospel is all about following Jesus, Jesus being on the way to Jerusalem, and there's a heavy focus on the disciples, particularly on their failures, on their lack of understanding, on their lack of faith, on their pride, and other aspects of this discipleship. So in this section, in each one of these chapters, chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10, Jesus gives a prediction of his crucifixion and his resurrection. And each one of the predictions in this section follows the exact same pattern. There are five elements to each prediction, and each one of them has all five of these elements. Each one has it in the same order. Number one, there's private instruction for the 12 that is emphasized. In other words, these are not public declarations to the crowd that Jesus is making, but these are private statements to his 12 disciples. Number two, Jesus identifies himself in each one of these predictions as the Son of Man who will suffer. Number three, suffering and death will be at the hands of men. Number four, he will be killed as a result of the rejection and suffering that comes on him. And number five, he will rise from the dead in 3 days. So each one of these predictions in this section follows this exact same pattern. And though they follow this same pattern, when you look at each prediction, you will notice that they do vary a little bit from one to the other, not in anything that would contradict or be inconsistent, but rather that as you start from the first, go to the second, and then get to the third, which is where we are this morning, each one seems to add a little bit to the picture. And when you combine them all together, you get a very full and accurate prediction of what's going to happen to Jesus in Jerusalem. Now, the incident, as Mark relates it to us here in verses 32 to 34, is heavy with terms of discipleship, things that are related to following Jesus. That is a focus in this section of Mark's gospel. So in verse 32, he talks about being in the way, about Jesus being before them or in front of them, and them following after, them coming behind Jesus. And this statement is followed then by the prediction itself. So Jesus makes it abundantly clear that the call to follow him is the call to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow after him, going in his steps. So he is preparing his disciples, on the one hand, for his own suffering, as they are not prepared for it. And he's preparing for them, on the other hand, for their suffering for his sake, which they are also not prepared for, as we have already encountered a number of times and still have a couple of instances left here in chapter 10, as they're only thinking thoughts about the great rewards, the great position that they're going to have, and which one of them is actually going to be in the highest position in his kingdom. So we want to look at this prediction in two parts. In verse 32, where Mark tells us how that they were afraid. And in verses 33 and 34, which give us the actual prediction where Jesus says he will be condemned to death. So in verse 32, the disciples were afraid. And they were in the way going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus went before them, and they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid. And he took again the 12 and began to tell them what things should happen unto him. So Mark obviously highlights this theme of discipleship that is such a feature of this section of his gospel. He adds here that they were going up to Jerusalem. So Jesus' ministry in Galilee has ended. He has moved with purpose, though this is the first mention in this section of Jerusalem. In fact, he hasn't mentioned Jerusalem by name since chapter 7. So Jesus has been moving about, and Mark has been plain that he's moving with a purpose. And now he opens up even further to clarify that that destination is, in fact, Jerusalem. That's where Jesus has been on the way to, particularly since this section opened earlier in chapter number 8. Now, this has been the general direction, even though, you know, we had that northern part of his trip where he went up into Caesarea Philippi and then had the transfiguration. And then after that, he's been moving south toward Jerusalem from that time. So Jesus' first prediction of his being killed, this is back in chapter number 8, his first prediction of his being killed mentioned the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes as rejecting him. So in other words, Jerusalem was obviously a key location for this event. And I believe that the disciples understood that much. Mark also points out that Jesus went in front of them. I mean, just look at the way that Mark writes this. They're going in the way up to Jerusalem. He says, and Jesus went before them. And if that's not enough, he makes a statement just a little later, and as they followed. So Mark points out that Jesus is literally walking in front of the disciples. And they are literally following behind Jesus. So when we talk about following Jesus, generally, I mean, when we're talking about following Jesus, we're generally being a little more figurative than that. We're not talking about going over to Israel and retracing his steps and movements through the 3 years of his life or his ministry that we know of. We're not being quite that literal. Here, Mark is being very literal about Jesus walking on the road to Jerusalem. He's in front of the disciples, and the disciples are behind him. So he's literally walking. Well, what Mark is showing us is that Jesus is moving with a willing purpose toward his death. In other words, the death of Jesus is not something that comes as a surprise and as a shock. Jesus had been giving hints prior to this, and then we get to this part where when he actually turns toward Jerusalem, and we see he begins then to predict this death. So Mark is showing us, he's highlighting to us, how that Jesus is moving with a willing purpose toward his death, and is actually leading his disciples in that road. He's not being drug along. He's not being carried along. It's not something that's going to sneak up on him. He's moving toward it knowingly. He's already twice predicted it, and he's also confirmed it in his discussion with the disciples about the coming of Elijah, back in chapter 9 and verse number 12. So Mark makes two notes in this verse about the state of the disciples as they are walking behind Jesus. So literally what they are doing is walking behind Jesus. He's in front of them. What is going on within them, Mark tells us in two ways. He tells us, first of all, that they were amazed. So they're walking along behind Jesus, and they're amazed. Well, that word means that they were astonished. And it's the same word that's used back up in verse 24, meaning that they are continuing in their astonishment about what Jesus said about riches and being saved. So they're continuing on in that sort of astonishment. They're trying to reconcile that in their minds. But he also notes, aside from this astonishment, he also notes they were afraid. They were frightened. Could even mean terrified. They were in the same state after Jesus' second prediction of his coming death in chapter 9 and verse 31. They were afraid of what he had told them. Now, the fact that they were afraid meant that they were not totally ignorant of what Jesus had been saying. I know sometimes we can maybe emphasize their misunderstanding or their slowness to understand to the point where it seems like they have no understanding. They're just completely missed everything. That's not the case. They know enough to be afraid. Jesus is heading toward Jerusalem, and even though on the one hand they have this amazement, this astonishment going on, that they're still trying to grapple with what Jesus said about riches and the danger that they present to men's souls. And then on the other hand, they're actually afraid, at least to some degree, of what's about to happen. Now, they had not understood what Jesus had talked about fully. They hadn't, obviously. But they were forming some conception of what he meant, and that heading to Jerusalem was walking toward suffering rather than away from it. In other words, Jesus, when he first predicted his death, had said that the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of Israel would be the ones that rejected him and he would be killed, meaning that Jerusalem is going toward the danger and not away from it. So they understood it well enough that they actually had some experience of fear that they were on the way to Jerusalem. Jesus is out in front of them, leading them there. Now, the second part of the verse, in verse 32, is where the prediction cycle begins again, more specifically. He says, "And he took again the 12 and began to tell them what things should happen unto him." So he took the 12 aside for private instruction, and in some way he has separated them, it would seem. Now, there could have been some other people that were following Jesus. We know that he has been around a couple of crowds recently in his movements. We know that he was around some crowds when he had come into Perea, there nearer to Jerusalem. So there could have been some other people that were following Jesus as he moved about. That happened quite frequently. And it could be the fact that there were just others on the road with them. Mark at least seems to indicate that. There were at least some others around. Of course, it was close to the Passover. And so there would be many that would be traveling to Jerusalem, so that wouldn't be uncommon at all. But in whatever way, Mark makes a point that Jesus is giving this instruction to the 12 disciples themselves, not in general, not a public declaration. And his message, Mark tells us, is about what things should happen unto him. Now, the word for should, it might seem like that's, you know, not that interesting of a word, you know, that these things should happen. But the word actually does have the idea of inevitability to it. It expresses an intention or purpose. It's not just that it was soon to happen, which it does have the idea of some nearness of time, that it is soon going to happen. But it's also expressing that purpose, which we see reflected in the other predictions as well. In chapter 8 and verse 31, Jesus began his prediction there by saying that these things must happen. These things must come to pass. In chapter 9 and verse 12, when he was talking with the disciples about the coming of Elijah after the transfiguration, he referred to that suffering of the Son of Man as being according to what was written. In other words, again, highlighting the fact that this must happen because it has been planned. It has been purposed. There is some intention here. It's deliberate. Well, then we come to verses 33 and 34 where we get the actual prediction itself. And Jesus tells them that he will be condemned to death. Verse number 33, saying, "Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles." So Jesus begins the prediction by stating that they are going up to Jerusalem, which might seem obvious, but the repetition of Jerusalem in this incident actually highlights what is going to happen there. And Jesus uses this title, you notice, Son of Man. And the title Son of Man is only used by Jesus of himself. So in other words, when Jesus asked his disciples, you know, "Who do men say that I am?" Well, Son of Man was not one of those titles. Some say Elijah. Some say one of the prophets. Herod thought that Jesus was John that had been resurrected from the dead and come back to life to take revenge on him or something. But Son of Man was not one of those titles. Sometimes some in the crowd would refer to Jesus even as Son of David. But Son of Man is only ever used by Jesus himself. But the title Son of Man is actually used in each of these three predictions in this section. And the title is not without precedent in the Old Testament. It does appear a number of times. Sometimes it just simply refers to human beings, descendants of Adam. But most commonly it's used as an actual title in the book of Ezekiel, as God addressed the prophet himself, Ezekiel, by that title numerous times. But probably the most significant usage of this title actually comes in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And there in Daniel it is used in relation to the Son of Man, who is the one that comes with the clouds of heaven and receives the everlasting kingdom from the Ancient of Days who sits upon his throne. Obviously being then a messianic title. Well, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man in the Gospel of Mark 15 times. Two times that are early. In chapter 2 and verse 10, Jesus says that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins. In chapter 2 and verse 28, he says that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, the majority of the appearances of Son of Man in Mark are actually spoken in connection with the death and resurrection of Jesus. So you get 9 out of those 15 times here, chapter 8, verse 31, chapter 9, verses 9 and 12 and 31, chapter 10, verse 33, where we are this morning, later in verse 45, and then toward the end of Mark in chapter 14, verses 21 and 41. And then we get specific mention of his return in the clouds of glory with power 4 out of those 15 times, or the rest of those times, chapter 8, verse 38, chapter 13, verses 26 and 34, and chapter 14, verse 62. So in other words, this title, Son of Man, is obviously significant. It is obviously a messianic title. It is obviously connected to the death and resurrection and return and reign of Jesus Christ as King. Now, he combines, you'll notice in verse 33, if you look at the other two predictions, you'll see that he combines here from those earlier predictions, and he says that he will be delivered unto the chief priests and the scribes, which is what he predicted in chapter 8, verse 31, but he did not say that in chapter 9, verse 31. He merely said there he would be delivered into the hands of men. So he goes on to fill out this picture about the scribes and the chief priest. He'll be delivered into their hands. He says, and they shall condemn him, that is the Son of Man, to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles. So he says of the chief priests and scribes, back in chapter 8, he said they would reject him. And here he says they will condemn him to death. Well, the leaders of Israel, of course, did not have the authority to actually execute Jesus, but they could condemn him, and they could get the Romans to execute him, which is what they did. Now, the condemnation obviously explains the rejection that he had predicted earlier in chapter 8 and verse 31. It also speaks of the fact of an official judgment with a death sentence being given. Now, when you go on in the account, you will read of the trials that Jesus was subjected to. And he actually did stand public trials. And all the lengths that the leaders of Israel went to give some semblance of a judicial process. And in fact, when you look into the accounts, you find that ultimately they had to bribe some false witnesses in order to have a public testimony against Jesus to be able to condemn him. Verse 34, and they shall mock him, and shall scourge him, and shall spit upon him, and shall kill him. And the third day he shall rise again. So Jesus adds some graphic detail here to what the Gentiles will do to him. And he gives four actions: mock, scourge, spit, and kill. One thing that's remarkable about these actions is that all of these are predicted to happen to the Messiah in the Old Testament. So for instance, Isaiah chapter 50 and verse 6, that's about the servant of Yahweh being rejected. I gave my back to the smiters, and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. Chapter 53 and verse 3, which continues speaking about the servant of Yahweh and his rejection. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we esteemed him not. In verses 7 to 9, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. Which actually, those verses are astounding in the accuracy of their prediction. When you dig into the language that's being used in those verses, Isaiah is actually prophesying that Jesus, the Messiah, the servant of Yahweh, would be condemned in an unfair trial with no one to speak to his defense, and would die as a common criminal, be buried with the rich in a rich man's tomb. In verse 12 of Isaiah 53, therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sins of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. Not only in Isaiah, though this was written 700 years before Jesus lived, we have even an older prophecy, about 1,000 years before the days when Jesus was speaking these words to his disciples. King David wrote in Psalm 22, verses 6 to 7, but I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head. And you go on down to verses 12 to 18. Many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round. They gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. Now hast brought me into the dust of death, For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I may tell all my bones. They look and stare upon me. They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. Of course, Psalm 22 being perhaps one of the most well-known messianic psalms and prophecies of the crucifixion of the Messiah. Jesus also mentions being killed, shall be mocked, scourged, or beaten, shall be spit upon. In other words, publicly humiliated and despised, and shall kill him. Executed. Being killed is also in each of those predictions. But Jesus also predicts at the end of verse 34, and the third day he shall rise again. In each of the predictions, he states that in the time of 3 days after he is killed, he will rise again. He predicts his soon death, but also a soon resurrection. And this is something that was quite puzzling to the disciples back in chapter 9 and verse number 10, where Mark tells us how they disputed among themselves what Jesus should mean that he should rise from the dead. In other words, in 3 days after he had been killed. So Mark highlights in this particular episode how that the disciples were amazed and afraid. Their amazement speaks to the fact that they did not have a clear understanding of what Jesus was teaching them. Now, this discipleship section starts with the healing of the blind man from Bethsaida back in chapter 8. And you remember one of the things that's so unique about that healing episode is that it happens in two stages. The blind man goes from blindness, no sight, to seeing men like walking trees. In other words, he has blurred vision. And then he goes to clear sight. And it's obvious that the disciples still don't see clearly. They're astonished. They're amazed. They are afraid. Now, Jesus' teachings clearly echo the Old Testament predictions of the suffering and the death of the Messiah. One of the reasons why I read several verses, and that by no means is that all that's in the Old Testament predicting the suffering and death of the Messiah. And he also explicitly told them that his future sufferings were according to what was already written. That's back in chapter 9 and verse number 12. So in other words, they should have seen more clearly than they did, but they didn't. And they were also afraid. Their fear shows that they understood something. They understood enough to be afraid. They understood something of what Jesus said, and they were frightened by it. So what was the problem with the disciples? And again, as we talked about so much earlier in this discipleship series, what really is the problem with you and I and all those that would follow Jesus? Well, the problem is blindness. They're just like that man from Bethsaida. They were just seeing those men as walking trees. They didn't see clearly. And that was partly because of their lack of faith. And that's what we saw in chapter 9, verses 28 to 29. Remember when they could not cast out the demons out of that little boy? They couldn't do it. And it was a failure of faith on their part. It was also partly, their blindness was also partly due to their preoccupation with reward and greatness. Their minds were obviously fixed on that, and we'll see that in evidence in the next episode that follows that we'll cover the next time. Their minds were fixed on this reward and this ranking and where they were and which one of them was the greatest and who was going to have and get what. Now, Jesus could not be clearer that for the disciples then and for those who would follow Jesus today, following him is following him on the road of suffering. And we, like they, must beware of pride that blinds us. And it might in fact mean that we are on the wrong road because we don't see what we ought to see. Thank you.